This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Just to give a little background about the session, I wanted to put some structure on it. So I'm showing here a model proposed nearly 30 years ago by Malcolm Pike that he referred to as breast tissue aging, where breast cancer susceptibility is highest perhaps when women are exposed to both estrogen and progesterone at the same time. So essentially, this morning's session focused on menopause is considering how menopause may be a time when window susceptibility is closing and represents the end of the reproductive lifespan window susceptibility. And you can see how I've marked the other windows that we've heard about yesterday about puberty around the time of first full-term pregnancy, and now we're talking about menopause. And in particular, this morning's session, I want to focus on how if women are exposed to estrogen and progesterone or things that mimic estrogen and progesterone, what we may be doing is extending this window of susceptibility. And hopefully not a lame attempt at an analogy, perhaps we think we're closing a window, but in fact we're just closing a screen because we're not closing the window entirely. We're continued to be exposed to these hormones after menstruation ends. So this morning, the session will begin with Dr. Marcia Stefanik, who is a professor of medicine at the Stanford Prevention Research Center and also a member of the Stanford Cancer Research Institute.
Thank you, Amy. When I was asked to do this and they asked about menopause as a window of susceptibility, I felt like, well, maybe it's a window of opportunity. That's how we keep talking about it in the hormone world. And so I wanted to kind of bring that position into perspective. And I'm going to be emphasizing the Women's Health Initiative, which I'm one of the principal investigators for. But what I'd like to start with is to make the point in terms of opportunity. The slide that I put up here for you is one to make the point that when you actually look at the epidemiological data, menopause is something that we kept hearing in the cardiovascular world that women are protected against heart disease until menopause and then they lose protection. But in fact, the epidemiology from study after study shows pretty clearly that in fact, it's a very linear relationship that basically it's just age. There isn't any evidence of a deflection with menopause. On the other hand, when we talk about breast cancer, even though breast cancer is clearly higher in older women, it's a very steep curve in terms of the increase in breast cancer in the premenopausal years. And then menopause shows a very clear time of deflection, and the curve basically flattens out as the endogenous estrogen levels drop. And to just show you, I don't know if you can see here on the bottom, but to just give you another example, we can see this menopausal deflection with something like bone mineral density, where you have in blue on the bottom, this is the drop of bone mineral density in men, very steady. Women have a similar curve for decreasing bone mineral density until menopause, and then there's an accelerated loss, and then it resumes its normal course. So we can see biological changes at menopause in breast cancer and in osteoporosis that we don't see in heart disease. Now, my focus is on hormone therapy, and I don't call it hormone replacement therapy. That was the original way that it was defined back in 1942 when it first became FDA approved. Conjugated equine estrogens, which relates to horses, these are basically extracted from the urine of pregnant horses, was shown to prevent to ameliorate vasomotor symptoms, and that was really one of the most serious concerns for menopause, and that was what it was approved for. And then it was kind of assumed that we need to replace this, and there's a lot of controversy about do we really need to replace hormones. There is that a brief period of time when women have vasomotor symptoms that are uncomfortable. But because of this, and there was a great marketing, a lot of women started going on these hormones, and so we started to develop an observational study database that slowly was giving us associations in the women who were taking them. So the first group of women were women who were worrying about bone fractures. They tended to be thin, white women. And so thin white women were the early users, and the early users, then we started seeing breast cancer showing up in the estrogen use in these thin white women, and eventually we started getting other data saying that whereas we had reduced fractures in this group and we had elevated breast cancer in that group, we were getting fewer cardiovascular diseases. These women were thin. They were a slightly different group of women than the general population. And so our observational database was very biased, and it takes a long time to get rid of biases that go into that literature. Nonetheless, what you see in this curve at the bottom is the prescriptions of menopausal hormones were going up very steadily with marketing. A book came out, Feminine Forever, that pretty much marketed the idea that we would stay young and beautiful and sexual and all of these things that weren't proven at all. We had no data to support that whatsoever. But who doesn't want a pill that's going to prevent you from aging? So it was very attractive. And it did increase prescriptions until it was reported in the mid-70s that women who were taking estrogen unopposed were getting cancer of the uterus at very high rates. And that explains that big drop that you see. That is a very scary message for the population. So they came off their hormones. And then the endocrinologist said, well, if we add progestin, we could basically overcome that problem. And as the evidence came to support the idea that we would prevent the endometrial cancer, the cancer of the uterus, women started taking it again. And there's a lot of marketing that was basically putting women back on these hormones. Plus, they do feel better at menopause. Now, there weren't any real randomized clinical trials until 1995. The PEPI study was started focusing on heart disease. And actually not disease, it was risk factors. And then HERS, which was a study of women with heart disease. So we didn't really have a lot of data on estrogen and progestin in particular in the observational literature. Now, this is really a more recent study in the sense that we were already getting plenty of epidemiology that was trying to look at what's that relationship of hormone use to breast cancer. And the Million Women study in 2003, so it was actually right after the Women's Health Initiative estrogen and progestin trial came out, but they reported that in their large sample of women, about half of them were using menopausal hormones, and they were able to look at the relationship of that hormone use to non-use in this large population. And they confirmed much epidemiological literature that came before that the hormone users as a group had about 66% higher rates of breast cancer, but that when you broke it out by estrogen only, you had a much lower risk than if you had estrogen and progestin. So for estrogen and progestin, the risk was twofold. And that was significantly more than estrogen only. Now, the curious point I want to make here is that the observational literature up to this point was pretty much suggesting that this estrogen, this increase of breast cancer with estrogen was specific to lean women and not seen in obese women and overweight women. So that's an important point to remember as I take you through the Women's Health Initiative. Now, the Women's Health Initiative was a very large study that had multiple trials. I'm only going to focus on the hormone trial. And this is a study of women who were 50 to 79 when they started, followed over a long period of time, conducted across the country at 40 clinical centers, and we have been continuing to follow the women ever since. And to just give you the design of the study, in the hormone trial, the first question was, does a woman have a uterus or not? Because that basically put her into one of two different trials. So the issue is not that we had the same population pool, but based on hormone use, you would either be, based on hysterectomy status, you would either be in the estrogen and progestin trial. If you had a uterus, it was still believed very strongly and still is that progestin is important to prevent endometrial cancer, and so that's added with estrogen. And in the case of a woman who's had a hysterectomy, there's no need for the progestin, and so that's an estrogen-only design. So what you see is that these are very large trials. The estrogen and progestin trial, which I'll call E plus P, was 16,608 women, randomly assigned to either conjugated equine estrogen, so these estrogens derived from horses, or placebo. And by the way, Premarin, which this estrogen, is still the most widely used estrogen for hormone therapy in the country today. Or they were put in the estrogen-only trial, which was just the estrogen. Oh, and the medroxyprogesterone acetate was the progestin. It was given every day through the study. So essentially, it was two trials, and people often don't get that clear. There are two very different populations in these trials. One population are women with hysterectomy, and there are different reasons that women get hysterectomy that really does make them quite different from women who have their uterus. The main outcome was heart disease, but breast cancer was always seen as the most important adverse outcome, potentially adverse outcome, and so it was an important secondary outcome, as were colorectal cancer and uterine cancer, if you had a uterus, and then other cardiovascular outcomes and hip fractures. Again, very large studies. The estrogen-only study was nearly 11,000 women. Originally planned to go 8.5 years, but because of risk-benefit analyses, they were both stopped short, particularly E plus P. So to just give you a schematic of the hypotheses, if you take the fact that we're trying to look at risk and benefits, I'm starting off with a scale here, and we had expected benefit from the observational literature for coronary heart disease, and that expected benefit was so high that the expectation was that we could handle the risk, the anticipated risk for breast cancer. In the middle there is stroke, because the reality is the observational literature wasn't very clear on what was going on with stroke and heart disease and hormones. It was bouncing back and forth in the literature. On the other side of benefit, we did actually expect to see benefit for fractures, reduced hip fractures, and we did expect to see harm for blood clots based on largely the oral contraceptive literature as opposed to the menopausal literature. And so to just jump to the chase, the estrogen and progestin trial, which is different then from the estrogen trial, had early observation, much earlier than anticipated, of breast cancer risk. And this was a priori stopping point, but it wouldn't have stopped the trial. Oh, I guess I need to tell you. The way that this balance was set up is neither of these risks or benefits would stop this trial unless they were consistent with an overall picture in the direction of benefit or harm. So what you see at the bottom, this global index, is building into the model every other outcome that a woman is getting. So that, for instance, if there are a lot more breast cancers occurring before you got the benefit to heart disease, that could stop the trial. But as long as the balance was still, it looks like, you know, overall, you put this into the woman and there's all kinds of things that can happen with the hormones. Overall, she didn't look worse off or better off, the trial would continue. So what happened first was the breast cancer flag went up on the estrogen and progestin trial. That would not have stopped the trial because by that time there was, in fact, enough benefit with respect to fewer hip fractures and fewer colorectal cancers that would have balanced and kept the balance intact. But the problem was all the cardiovascular hypotheses were wrong, and we actually ended up with cardiovascular risk and breast cancer risk, and together that sunk the ship and the study was stopped. Now, an interesting point is a lot of press came out. People were really surprised about this. But then immediately people started asking about, well, how does this relate to menopause? These are older women. These women are on average 63 years of age. And I just want to make the point that, in fact, an average doesn't give you the full story, and it's really important to look at the full story. In the Women's Health Initiative, we had goals for ages. We actually cut the study off to younger women when we had met our goals for the 50 to 59 group. But just to point out, nearly a third of this trial were women that we would consider in the menopausal range, early postmenopause at the worst, and that this is the largest study ever done on a menopausal age cohort. So that was the point, and this is true of both the estrogen-only and the estrogen and progestin trial. So the next point is the estrogen-only trial marched along. We tried to convince the women they should stay in the study. I will say a lot of women were coming off their study pills because that was a bit scary, and we built that all into the intention-to-treat model, sensitivity analyses, which look at who's taking it. And the most important point on this slide before I put any data on is that we had no increase in breast cancer at the time that this study was stopped. There was no signal whatsoever of a problem with breast cancer with estrogen only. And we also had no effect on cardiovascular disease and nothing on colorectal cancer. What stopped the trial was the fact that just as we had seen in the estrogen and progestin trial, there was this increased risk of stroke. And even though there was a balance in terms of fewer hip fractures, the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute said, we just can't continue a study that is showing this increase in stroke. We have other drugs for bones. Let's focus on that. So to just kind of summarize these two trials, they were very consistent in showing no benefit to heart disease, which is really where the big marketing was going, and showing harm for stroke and blood clots, and in the case of the estrogen and progestin, early harm for cardiovascular disease. Both studies were clear that these hormones are great for fractures. We had a sub-study of dementia that showed that for older women, they were bad, that basically we had double probable dementia occurring in those women. It wasn't just vascular dementia, as many people thought, because of the stroke issue. In terms of what was different was the breast cancer, and that still is a very interesting story. Clearly increased in the estrogen and progestin trial, and no increase at the time that we stopped the trial. Colorectal cancer also differed in the two trials, so clearly this estrogen and progestin in that cohort differed from estrogen only in the women with hysterectomy in terms of its risk-benefit analysis. So that the global index, which was this overall picture, was clearly one of harm for the group of women that were in the estrogen and progestin trial, and a rather neutral finding for estrogen only. So what's one possible explanation? And there are many, but one that I think is worth talking about is coming back to the epidemiological literature that was saying that the estrogen-only harm was only seen in lean women in these other trials, or predominantly that was kind of the weight of the data. And when you look at these two trial cohorts, it turns out that a cohort of women with hysterectomy is a more obese cohort. And maybe even their obesity was one of the reasons they got hysterectomy, because it does cause bleeding because of unopposed estrogen. So it actually is one of the things that might determine a woman getting a hysterectomy. But the important thing is, by and large, the estrogen-only trial was a trial not of lean women, but of women who were actually obese. And that may be something that we really have to keep remembering. It isn't just estrogen and progestin versus estrogen. That said, I do want to point out that when we look at the cumulative incidence of breast cancers rising here, what you see is that in the red is the active estrogen and progestin group compared to the placebo in blue. And you can see that between years 1 and 3, there are actually fewer breast cancers diagnosed in the estrogen and progestin trial for the active treatment. And then they came out of the woodwork. And they really didn't come out of the woodwork. They came out of the breast dense breast tissue. Basically, what we learned is that mammography is not as good if you have dense breasts, which is another consequence of estrogen and progestin. And so the tumors were not being picked up until they were, in fact, larger and had spread to more lymph nodes. And we actually have data that, when we follow the trial, that there was evidence that the women who had been assigned to these active estrogen and progestin pills were at higher risk for death and mortality because it was more advanced breast cancer. Now, we actually stopped the trial, got women off the hormones, and what you're seeing is after the intervention, we continue to follow them. And we did continue to see more breast cancers emerging for a period of time. Probably those tumors had been there and we couldn't detect them because the mammography is not as good, is not as sensitive if you have denser breasts. But as the breast tissue reduced its density, we started to be able to pick up those tumors. And this complicated slide basically is showing you analysis where we actually did time-dependent breast cancer rates. And on the upper panel in the clinical trial, you see during the intervention this very steep, steady rise of breast cancers. And then when they stopped the intervention, a really nice decline in breast cancers. And I'll just let you know, we also had our own observational study in the WHI. And what you can see from that curve is that you probably can't read the numbers, but essentially women who on their own were taking estrogen and progestin compared to women who on their own were not, had a twofold higher increase in breast cancer, just like the Million Women study. And what you may not be able to see at the bottom of that is that when the Women's Health Initiative news came out, women came off their hormones at a pretty high rate, not only in WHI, by the way, in the whole country. I'll show you that next. And as they came off, we were actually able to see in our follow-up of these women this drop in the breast cancer rates in our observational trials. So the women who were coming off, their rates of breast cancer were coming down. And to just let you see, this actually was shown in the whole country. So this is actually giving you the estrogen and progestin data for hormone use in the whole country over this period of time. And you can see the reaction of the population to the WHI 2002 news, and then continued reaction when the estrogen-only trial came out. And the really interesting issue is that from the SEER data, based on breast cancer, you can actually see this decrease across the entire country in breast cancer as women were coming off those hormones. Very specific to the estrogen receptor positive tumors, really nothing with estrogen receptor negative tumors. So this is really observational literature to support the strong clinical trial findings. And to kind of bring this to conclusion, the estrogen-only trial I mentioned had not increased breast cancer. If you actually look at the cumulative incidence of the breast cancer diagnoses in that trial, the blue is placebo, the red is estrogen-only. What you can see is that throughout the entire trial, we saw fewer breast cancers, and we did not see denser breasts in the estrogen-only group. So the estrogen and progestin, we demonstrated there were denser breasts. This had very minimal effect on breast density. And even when the women stopped, we continued seeing this difference, so that by the time we actually looked at the whole period of observation on hormones, off hormones, in the estrogen-only group, which again I'll point out was a more obese population, in every age group, we did not see an increase. We actually saw this is quite significant for each age group, but a consistent story across the age group. And so I'm just going to end by saying, what are our current recommendations for menopausal hormone therapy? The recommendations are not to use these for chronic disease prevention. The recommendations are still for menopausal hormones, just as they were back in 1942. I'm sorry, for menopausal symptoms, moderate to severe symptoms, but using the lowest dose that's effective for the shortest time that's effective. We don't talk about go on it for the rest of your life. Also for vulvar vaginal symptoms, so dryness, problems with intercourse. There we would recommend, if that's your main concern, topical vaginal products, topical estrogens could be used. And finally, for preventing osteoporosis, preventing bone loss, if you are concerned about that issue, but only after trying the other choices and starting out with low dose. So these are the three current FDA indications for using menopausal hormones, and we no longer encourage women to go on it to prevent heart disease, dementia, or even bone loss, really, because we talk about other issues. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll hold all of our questions to the end. And so next we'll hear from Dr. Mary Beth Terry.
Great, and I wanted to thank Amy and the other organizers for a great conference, and in particular, I really enjoyed the poster session last night. I was really impressed with all of the high school students in particular and their posters, and particularly, I was really doubly impressed by all the students from Long Island who lost an entire week of school and still have these outstanding posters. So I wish I was as productive post-Sandy, and so a lot of what I'm going to show, unfortunately, is a little preliminary. But as Marcia just showed us, one of the major periods of importance for breast cancer risk is the menopausal period. And as all of you know, throughout the past 2 days, we've been focusing on different periods, the in utero period, puberty and pregnancy, and then now this morning, menopause. And so the importance of menopause in shaping breast cancer risk, because that's where the majority of breast cancers actually occur, is as Marcia showed, incredibly relevant. And that period, breast cancer risk can be manipulated in a very large way through hormone replacement therapy as well as weight reduction and thinking about exercise. But that's to say that these other windows also of susceptibility exist earlier in life is not to negate the importance of menopause, but really to appreciate the fact that what we know now from a number of different lines of evidence from animal data, from migrant studies, is really that susceptibility can begin earlier in life. And in particular, what seems to be intriguing and emerging evidence is coming up is more the importance of individual trajectories and thinking about the timing of these kinds of events as we go forward in looking at breast cancer risk. And as Amy showed you earlier, the Pike model and thinking about breast cancer risk in general has always been really thinking about the rate of change. And even though the majority of cancers happen postmenopausally, the rate of change in thinking about your risk really happens premenopausally, and that trajectory that you start on earlier in life can be very important for shaping risk. So as all of us in the room care deeply about what we're trying to do with finding out earlier periods of life and exposures and vulnerable windows is to really find out if we can change those trajectories and shape risk in that way. So really what I want to do very simply in a brief period of time that we're here today is really talk about how these prenatal and early life exposures relate to these different windows. And I know this morning we're talking about menopause specifically, but what I want to do to bring us back is to think about the role of earlier life events, both in terms of thinking about the timing of menopause, but also other intermediate markers. And in particular, if the question that we want to know is if exposures are related to breast cancer risk ultimately, which is our endpoint of interest, do these same exposures work through these earlier markers and endpoints represented through these windows? And so what we've been doing for a number of years now is dealing with trying to understand these questions from human studies. And I think what's come from all of this is, you know, if you had to do it all over again, I wish I could do animal work, because the kinds of precision and questions that you can answer within an animal framework are very compelling, as everyone has seen over the past few days. But dealing with sort of the messiness of reality and with humans, as Esther John spoke about yesterday, the difficulty of using a lot of retrospective studies to get at these earlier exposures is hard because these kind of exposures are just really hard to recall. And so the human studies, if we want to think about prospective measurements, what we've been trying to do is rejuvenate these birth cohorts that exist in the U.S. So rather than start de novo, which obviously would also be an approach, but you'd have to wait many, many years, what we tried to do over the past decade, three-quarters of which we've really spent time just collecting the data, now we're just starting to generate results from these data, is really focus on cohorts that have existed in the U.S., and primarily we've been focusing on two major cohorts, the California Health and Study Development cohort in collaboration with Barbara Cohn, and then the National Collaborative Perinatal Project. I've been leading the New York site, and then in collaboration with Karen Michaels, we've been following up the Harvard and Providence cohorts. So what we've been trying to do, because all of these U.S. birth cohorts, the babies were born in the 50s and 60s, these women are now, the offspring are all in midlife, so we can look at intermediate markers of risk. And so what we've been focusing on, again, are using these prospective constructs, which are really hard to recall in retrospectively decades later, but we have these data that are already existing, and now going back and thinking about how these same exposures can relate to different intermediate markers. And so primarily our major outcome of interest has been high mammographic density, because this can be measured reliably on all women who get mammograms. So the cohorts that we follow now are all in their late 40s, and so at the time that we conducted our studies, a lot of these women were getting mammograms for screening. And we also now, and the data I'll present today, include looking at how these same exposures relate to menopause and earlier age of menarche. So as many of you know, there's a number of risk factors for breast cancer, most of which are very modest. And so the two risk factors in particular relate to reproductive timing in terms of earlier menarche and late menopause are fairly modest risk factors, but very consistent and important nonetheless. And then mammographic density is another intermediate marker, which is a much stronger relationship with the endpoint of interest, breast cancer. And so the magnitude is important later on for interpreting effects that can be different across these different pathways, and so that's why I bring it to your attention now. So in particular, to think about the magnitude of effect with age of menarche and age of menopause, this past month in Lancet Oncology, there was an important study from the collaborative hormonal group, and this is a study of 300,000 women, so the precision was quite excellent. And you can see from these two graphs that when we talk about the sort of the window of menarche and the window of menopause. The window of menopause is double the size of the window of menarche. So if you look at sort of the range of menarche age, again, this is from collaborative work in 300,000 women, the range is from about 7 to 20, and Frank showed us yesterday how Tanner stage relates to the age of menarche with about a two-year earlier onset from the age of menarche. And then you can see, though, the menopause window is double that size, from 35 to 60 years. So again, this is going to be important with thinking about when you describe these windows and thinking about when you can enter these windows. But the focus of our interest is in terms of how these relate to, again, the endpoint of interest. So age of menarche, and again, this is from the same article that was published this past month, age of menarche, the earlier your menarche by 1 year increases your breast cancer risk by 1.05, so 5% per every year, and age of menopause is 3% for every year. So again, that seems little per year, but think about this long window, you know, that people, there's quite a large you know, population variation for these particular windows. And actually, the one probably most interesting thing that came out of this article was they looked, too, at the role of age of menarche and age of menopause at the type of breast cancer. And in particular, age of menarche mapped to all different breast cancers, whereas the age of menopause effect mapped primarily to the hormone receptor positive cancers. So that's also very important, because we are always trying to ask and figure out sort of what type of breast cancer, given that breast cancer is so heterogeneous, do these intermediate markers map to? So they published, again, really large and precise data on the fact that age of menarche was mapping to all different breast cancers, whereas age of menopause was primarily mapping to the hormone receptor positive. So again, what I'm going to present today is a collection of different studies we did through the CHDS cohort with Barbara Cohn and the National Collaborative Perinatal Project. I'll present some of the New York data that I've headed up, and then I'll show you some density data. And again, for the interest of the talk, I'm just going to focus on two areas of early life exposures. One, body size, because we've been really interested in looking at how growth rates work in terms of increasing breast cancer risk, but also thinking about prenatal smoke, because a number of people have been interested in the role of smoke and breast cancer, and it hasn't actually been a very easy story to understand. And so part of that could be because of the dual effect of smoking, which I'll talk about in a minute. And then specifically, I'll just review again very briefly these three outcomes. And again, one of the difficulties of human studies is because if we are going to rely on prospective measures of earlier life, then a lot of these studies, as you saw yesterday, we work with the Legacy study, I head up the New York study, a lot of these studies are small cohorts, and we rely on intermediate markers, just like the puberty studies here for BSERP do. So to the extent that we can interpret these intermediate markers in relation to breast cancer, we have to then understand whether or not these different exposures have similar effects across the different intermediate markers. Just to tell you again, so the age of menarche, we use self-reported recall data from the adult questionnaires. The menopause questions, we relied on the 60-day definition for perimenopause and the standard definition for natural menopause. And then for all the breast density, we measured that through a continuous measure called cumulus. So very briefly, for thinking about early life growth, there's been a number of studies now. Karen Michaels headed up one of the largest studies in the early 90s looking at birth weight within the nurses study. I just present one finding here from a New York State study. So New York isn't like Colorado and it isn't like North Carolina, so we're a little we're a little in the middle for a number of reasons. But anyway, what I thought was kind of compelling about this study, it linked to birth records, was this U-shaped association. Now, the U-shaped association with breast cancer risk, what was driving it was, as you can see on the very far left, is very extreme underweight babies. And so in some populations, you don't see this U-shaped relationship because you don't have enough people in that very small birth weight group. But in any event, I just raise it as one study to show you that, again, when we talk about these constructs and when we talk about birth weight, and a lot of the Barker hypothesis was talking about fetal growth and birth weight in particular, to realize also the complexity of any kind of measure. Marcia told us just sort of thinking about the complexity of hormonal measures and whether it's opposed or not. But any kind of measure, it's not necessarily a linear effect. And so to think about that kind of complexity when we interpret our data too. So one of the things that's interesting and that we tried to focus on was this idea not just of birth weight, but what happens right after birth. And so in particular, babies that are born really small have very rapid catch-up right after birth, and babies that are born bigger have slowed down. And now, not just in cancer, but a lot of cardiovascular outcome studies, the rate of growth afterwards is what is mapping to a lot of health disease later in life. And so this is just to show you sort of schematically on the x-axis is the percentile weight of birth. And as you can see, those babies that are born very big have then a smaller overall change between birth and seven. So we focus a lot of our effort in looking at these earlier periods of growth. And this is just using publicly available data from the entire National Collaborative Perinatal Cohort. So this is just 10,000 women that we looked at to look at body size changes. You can just see from this schematic that there's a lot of people that cross over, and a lot of people in particular during that first year of life that either increase in percentile or decrease. So what's along the diagonal are people that stay within 5 to 10 percentile growth. And you may know either from your own self or from your kids that staying within percentile growth during the first year of life is how you could measure sort of height and weight trajectories. But there are often these crossing of percentiles. So we use crossing 10 percentile of growth points as sort of a major change for looking at these growth. And you can see there's in green then are the people who were born small and then grew very rapidly. And in yellow are the people who were the opposite. And we could characterize people that way. And one thing I would just point out is that, again, for cancer risk as well as thinking about cardiovascular risk, this year of life, the first year of life, is really when most babies triple in size. So there's a lot of activity going on during that first year, and so a lot of height growth, a lot of weight growth, and so we had focused in that area. So I'll just show you a couple findings from the New York cohort, which was a smallish cohort, but what we looked at, again, was thinking about how these growth factors relate to age and menarche in the offspring and in the daughter. And so what you can see just by this graph was, again, even though there is this correlation that's been known for decades between mother's age at menarche and daughter's age at menarche, they're obviously... correlation is fairly modest, and so you can see on the right-hand panel the number of daughters who actually then had earlier menarche than their mother, but we also had a lot of girls who had later menarche than their mothers, and so again, to appreciate the role of environment and secular changes in this. And so in particular, what you can see then is when we focus on these periods of growth from birth to 4 months, 4 months to 1 year, and 1 to 7 years, all of these... in particular, this period here, all of these were below the zero bar, meaning that the faster you grew, the earlier your age at menarche was. And so this, again, is not surprising, knowing that childhood body growth at seven really has been shown for many, many decades to be related to earlier age at menarche. But what we found surprising was all of these effects are after considering and independent of your body size later at seven. So these are mapping to this independent effect of the rate of growth from 4 to 1 year in particular in this New York cohort, and we saw it across the different racial groups. So the New York cohort in particular was about one-third African-American, one-third Puerto Rican as classified as birth, and one-third white. So this is then data from the California site where we were looking at weight change, again, in these sort of early life time periods, and then looking at whether they map to earlier or later age at menarche. So here, actually, the comparison is relative to girls who have menarche 13+. So the fact that these are above, and this is a standardized coefficient, so the fact that these are above this horizontal bar means that weight growth, so rapid weight growth, even after adjusting for birth weight and later body size, weight growth during this particular time period still had this very persistent and independent effect on mapping to earlier age at menarche. So again, suggesting that the faster you grow very early, the first few months of life, this was a persistent effect with age at menarche. We also then looked at birth weight and mapping to breast density, which again is a very strong intermediate for marker for breast cancer. And the only thing I want to point out here is when we looked at birth weight by itself, there was this positive association, and birth weight, again, in many studies have been positively associated with breast cancer. And so this is mapping then to dense area. Here we show you dense area rather than percent density, but these next two models then we're adjusting for postnatal growth. So once you factored in the postnatal growth, birth weight wasn't independently related to breast density. But again, these patterns are all very important to look at together, because babies that are born big then tend to have slower growth later. And so that's what this then is just focusing on, the fact that those babies that grow very rapidly actually postnatally actually had lower density. So these would be babies that grow very rapidly because they were born small, and they actually then had lower density, which is a stronger risk factor for breast cancer than age at menarche. And then finally, what we're really all talking about today, and again, this is just the California data in collaboration with Barbara Cohn, what you can see here, these are the birth weight quartiles, is looking at, and again, our cohort is young. So these are women who went into natural menopause very early in life, so in their 40s. And so you can see this very strong effect of higher birth weight being less likely to be in natural menopause. Okay, so the higher your birth weight, actually, the more likely you were to still be premenopausal, which then is one way that you can increase your breast cancer risk. Okay, so very quickly then, I'll just go through a couple of our findings for prenatal smoke exposure. And one of the things that's been interesting with breast cancer in particular is that, unlike many other cancers like head and neck cancer, colon cancer, obviously lung cancer, bladder cancer, stomach cancer, that map to cigarette smoking, active cigarette smoking has been less clearly associated with breast cancer. And so many people have talked about this dual effect of smoking, where you have this anti-estrogenic effect of smoking. But there is now some consistent body of evidence suggesting that the longer duration you smoke, if you start early, if you start smoking prior to first pregnancy for active smoke, or importantly, if you have damage to any of your DNA repair genes, such as through BRCA1 or 2, that you may be more susceptible. So we were actually interested in prenatal smoke exposure. And the benefits of some of these U.S. cohorts for this particular exposure cannot really be minimized, because these cohorts, there were a lot of women smoking. You can see right here the prevalence of prenatal smoke is 40% in these cohorts in the mom. And these were women who smoked and during their pregnancy prior to the Surgeon General's report. Again, if you had to retrospectively ask about some of this information, it might be, you know, hard to do because of the social stigma attached to smoking now during pregnancy. So you can see there's actually a lot of smoking going on in our cohort. And then just very briefly, we looked at it with respect to age at menarche, not a real clear association for prenatal smoke exposure, a little higher, but not statistically significant. But interestingly, what we did find was that if you were exposed to either prenatal smoke exposure, and again, some of the benefit because of the secular changes in smoking is we actually had women who had their mom smoke during pregnancy, or themselves just smoked, or they had both sources of exposure. And you can see there's actually a very strong association, a fourfold association, for being in natural menopause if you had exposure to both. But actually, if you had no adult smoking, but your mom smoked while pregnant with you, there was also a strong increase in being in natural menopause. And so, again, this is kind of important to think about, sort of these life course effects of these exposures. And many people have already reported on and found current smoking being associated with natural menopause and earlier age of menopause. But this is showing that possibly other types of exposure, either in utero exposure and or passive smoke exposure during childhood. And so we also then finally looked at how the smoke related to density, and actually in all of these models, whether or not you had exposure prenatally but also actively, we found that that source of exposure related to lower mammographic density. We published these results last year, and this is just reflecting sort of the decrease in breast density from prenatal smoke exposure. And so finally, we just looked, again, because of the relationship between sort of density and menopause itself, whether this smoke exposure was seen across the different strata of menopausal status, and it was. And now what we're doing is really, for a subpart of our cohort, looking at repeated measures of density, because, again, what's going to be important is sort of the trajectory that you're on. So the yellow line here just represents the slope of the line for people who are premenopausal and looking at their change in density over time, which is a much less steep slope than women who are already in perimenopause. And about 20% of our cohort was already in perimenopause based on that 60-day definition. Women who are in natural menopause, which is represented by green. So finally then, just in summary, we had rapid growth during all these time periods in early infancy related to earlier age of menarche. We also saw higher birth weight, was less likely to have earlier menopause, higher rate of growth in the first 4 months, had lower breast density, even after accounting for menopausal status and the relationship between the two. And then we saw this non-statistically significant association with earlier menarche from prenatal smoke exposure. Those girls whose moms smoked during pregnancy were more likely to have earlier natural menopause and more likely to have lower breast density, even after accounting for menopausal status. So what I highlight in yellow then is for each of those exposure constructs, what would be associated then with higher breast cancer risk, right? So if you can see under the growth, two of those intermediate markers then mapped to higher breast cancer risk, but the other one did not, and likewise for prenatal smoke exposure, one of those, again, mapped, but the other two did not. So the implications, again, of thinking through some of this is that these earlier life exposures can be related to breast cancer risk in different ways and different pathways, and so these modest overall associations that we see with breast cancer from some of these earlier life effects may be because of these opposing effects, and we need to factor in models that would allow us to look for these different effects. And most importantly, I think, is we're going to have to consider individual trajectories and timing of when these events occur and think about the larger issues of when the window occurs and the decrease over time. So I'd like to just acknowledge my colleagues at Columbia, my colleague at the Public Health Institute of California, Barbara Cohn, and Pierre Cirillo, who we've been working together for a number of years on this, Kathy Schaefer, who collected all of the California data, and also my colleague at Harvard, Karen Michaels, who has been leading up the Boston cohort for these grants.
I think what we'll try to do now is that Marge Plum will talk for about 10 minutes or so, and then we'll have some time, hopefully, if you want to line up at the microphones, we can ask some questions.
Thanks. Thank you all very much, and thank you for the invitation to reflect on this panel. After a few framing remarks, I will ask my panelists, so you can start thinking, based on your study, what new research questions do you have? What new studies do you think would be really interesting to do? Amy, you started that a little bit at the end of your presentation, and this will give you a few minutes to think about that. Ever since being invited to provide reflections on this panel, I've been incredibly anxious. Will I understand the science well enough to add value? Will I be able to articulate my understanding of what is presented without making such huge mistakes that one of you have to jump up and immediately correct me? So over the last few days, I reviewed the abstracts and PowerPoints of my co-panelists. I even Googled menopause and breast cancer and got 35 million hits. That wasn't very helpful. And I kept grabbing everyone I knew yesterday, including two of my co-panelists, and asking, what does this study mean? Then I had to remind myself that I'm not a scientist, and that's not my role on this panel. I'm an advocate and have spent my entire life advocating for women's rights, lesbian rights, and the rights of the poor and other disenfranchised groups. And for me, this is also personal. The picture on the left is of my cousin Nancy, who died a week ago after fighting metastatic breast cancer for over 12 years. She had just begun believing that maybe, just maybe, she had beat this. And the picture on the right is of my mother-in-law, Diane, who died in 2008 of a uterine sarcoma subsequent to 10 years of tamoxifen treatment following a breast cancer diagnosis. For all of us here, whether personally motivated, scientifically driven, or both, finding the answer, any answer is so very compelling and important. I want to state out front that I love researchers. My wife is a researcher, and I think one of the smartest ones around. She's also chair of the Breast Cancer Action Board. So besides my own work with the California Breast Cancer Research Program, the Child Health and Development Study, and the Program on Reproductive Health and the Environment, all programs filled with brilliant scientists, Tracy, my wife, and I talk about breast cancer a lot. And the researchers in this room are just simply the cream of the crop of breast cancer and the environment researchers. I have absolute respect for the work you do. I want my remarks to help move us forward in our joint quest. I spent most of yesterday, as I said, trying to figure out actually what was being presented. I actually had a little daydream that we figured out how to do simultaneous translation. All of us who don't fully understand science sitting with headphones listening to someone say, well, I think what she means is. And I was heartened yesterday to have several epidemiologists actually confide in me that they really didn't understand the basic scientists either. And I suspect the feeling was probably mutual. Last night I asked Mary Beth and Amy to tell me what the results of their study mean in the larger context of our goal to find what the environment, what in the environment influences breast cancer risk. And one of them said, well, it sounds kind of simple, but the causes of breast cancer are really complex. And I realized in that moment that I'm not afraid of it being simple. I'm afraid of it being oversimplified. I want simple lay language, not because I think you know the cause of breast cancer, but have it hidden under words like fidelity and differentiation and mediating mechanisms. I want lay language because I want to be able to talk with you. I want to know what your study means, what your studies mean together, and where you think we should be going next. I know this is complex. I know because I live the complexity. I am an obese, hot-flashing, working-class lesbian who was raised in the pesticide-laden cornfields of the Midwest by parents who bought the Madison Avenue sales pitch of creating lives of ease and comfort through canned food, TV dinners, aerosol sprays, and cleaning products. I know I was raised in and am a Petri dish. And I know that trying to separate out my being bottle-fed from my mother smoking during pregnancy or separating my experience of homophobia from my diet is simple in understanding the complexity of homophobia, complexity of how those things might interact, and complex in understanding how we use science to find answers to the environment, to the environmental factors in breast cancer. So to my fellow panelists, in lay language, what do you think would be really cool to look at next?
I guess Amy wants me to start. So I'll say in the hormone therapy era, arena, I think we do need to separate the lean and the obese. I think that that's a really important one because if the risks really differ by those groups, then I think that's the idea that we're all the same needs to be, you know, teased apart. That said, I really found the data that Amy showed about the density. I think the breast density issue is such an important issue, and that's the same one in the hormone therapy world as well. And then the one other thing I'll say in the hormone world is, you know, we've been using these conjugated equine estrogens, which, you know, are not exactly, you know, normal for people. You know, there's like 20 different things in that, and that's what we're using. And so I think getting some better data on, you know, our endogenous estrogens or estrogens that are like our own estrogens, I think would really help us a lot.
Well, I guess I like I already said, I think it would be interesting to randomize women to behavioral lifestyle changes to see if we not only you'd have to consider whatever your environmental chemical of interest is, but if you're trying to avoid BPA, randomize women to avoid it and see what sort of health effects they are. Just because we certainly, it's not ethical to give women these chemicals and administer them, that doesn't mean we can't be more creative in how we do studies to evaluate their health effects. So.
Right. Marge, that was terrific challenge to everyone in the room. I think in terms of our focus for the next period, groups like this are really exciting because it definitely has to be solved by not just one way of thinking and the collection of thinking. And I think in particular in breast cancer, unlike some other cancers which have very strong intermediate markers, we really have had difficulty in doing either these life course studies because the intermediate markers are not there yet and or thinking about intervention studies later in life. So now... we know more about breast density than we ever have, but we still need to know a lot more, and I think we need repeated measures of density where we can look at changes over time and really take what we know now but go back to the models of Pike from the beginning to really put it all together. And I think that's why groups like this, particularly with the high school students that can help us out through all of this, we can really, I think, for the first time appreciate the complexity, but presented in a simple way. So simple presentation, I agree with you, is always important. But I think in a lot of this, we've tried to simplify the message and not really appreciated the complexity of these different pathways.
Thank you. Terrific. Thank you, and thank our panel.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.